Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, it's time to combine a little golf and a little comedy as we welcome comedic legend Tom Dreesen. So stay tuned to get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. All right. Welcome to the show. So glad you could be along. Ooh, I think my voice cracked there. Well, only because, you know, the guy that's coming on this hour cracked me up already numerous times getting him on the air. And I'm talking about a guy who's been on before, a guy who has so much history in the world of comedy and his balls around golf and everything else. So we said, hey, you know what? I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. We're thankful for a lot of things. And we're thankful for some friendships we built along the way, including this hour's guest. It's Tom Dreesen. This guy, one-man show, hung out with the likes of Sinatra and Sammy Davis. I'll let you, you know, he's an old guy. He's been around a long time. I mean, I don't know how to phrase this. Dreesen, welcome back, Dreesen.
That's great. I'll stop in at the Laugh Factory or the Comedy Show when I come off the road, and I'll go on stage and try out some new material. And usually the young comedians introduce me, they'll say, and we like to bring to stage a legend. He's a legend. And I get up on stage and I say, you know how I became a legend? All my critics are dead.
There's something to that. I had Bob Toski on recently, and Bob's the last living link golf-wise to the greats in the game. And talking about Ben Hogue and Sam Snead and some guys that I know you even hung out with over the years at all the golf tournaments that you emceed and played in.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I played in the Bob Hope Classic over 30 years. I was a master of ceremonies for the last, like, 18 years. And then I played in the AT&T also. Clint Eastwood had me up there for 22 years, and I'd also MC and perform at the annual ball. And then the Frank Sinatra had a tournament for 30 years, the Frank Sinatra Celebrity Invitational that I played in. And then also I was on a tour called the Celebrity Players Tour. It was basketball, baseball, football, hockey, tennis, and show business people that are 10 handicap or below. So it was Johnny Bench, Mike Schmidt, Mario Lemieux, John Elway, Dan Marino, Michael Jordan. We had 42 Hall of Famers. And show business, it was me, Jack Wagner, Matt Lauer, Brian Dunkel, Smokey Robinson. It was a fun tour. So golf, as much as I love comedy, golf has been a major part of my life. And also enhanced my comedy career, because every time you do these golf tournaments, at the end of the tournament, they'd want, you know, they'd have a dinner and a banquet, and they'd always want the comedian to get up and do 5 or 10 minutes, because you didn't need a band, you didn't need an orchestra. It was, you know, just you and the microphone. So when you perform for them in the audience were these Fortune 500 companies, Allstate, and American Airlines, IBM, they would hire me to do corporate dates. So my being a caddy as a boy, growing up poor with 8 brothers and sisters, and caddying turned out to be a blessing in my life. You know.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and you're based out of Chicago. I guess you finally got out of the cold, because my friends in Chicagoland are freezing these days. Not that a lot of America is not as well, in Canada, North America, if you will. It's interesting because you have been on the road for a long time, and you've done a lot of great things in your life, and some interesting things, and you've written a book, and et cetera, et cetera. When do you say, you know, I have to move a little slower or go a little slower, or do you never say that and you just go full bore like all the time?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because many years ago when I toured with Frank Sinatra, as you know, for 14 years in 45, 50 cities a year, doing 20,000 seat arenas and then Hawaii, 40,000. It was a really exciting tour. But I once said to him on his jet one day, I said, do you ever think about retiring? And he said, Tommy, we'll quit going to see them when they quit coming to see us. You know, I said, that's a pretty good answer. So as long as people are out there that want your comedy or your songs, then you want to keep going. Meanwhile, I'm a little bit hoarse because I just did too many shows in the last 2 weeks. So I'm drinking hot tea while I'm talking to you, you know.
Well, that's okay. As long as the check clears, then life is good.
Yeah, you know, also, what greater gift can a human being have than to find the work that you love? I really love stand-up comedy. I really love making people laugh. I write material and I go test it out that same night sometimes. And so you get an instant, you know, feedback, whether that's a good joke or not. You know, and I love that challenge. So as long as it's fun to go do it, then I don't see why anybody would. But, you know, George Burns lived to be 100 at age 95. You know, I went to see him when he was 95 years old. I was performing at Harrah's in Tahoe. He was at Caesars next door. And I went and caught a show at 95. He didn't run out to the microphone. But when he got out there, he did a strong hour and 10 minutes. Later, I went backstage to say hello to him. And he was reading 3x5 cards. And I said, "Hey, George." And he looked up and he said, "Hi, Tommy." He looked at the cards. He said, "I was trying out some new material tonight." I said, "That's what I want to do. I want to be 95 years old trying out new material. You know, when he was 95, Caesar's Palace offered him a 5-year contract. And he turned it down. He said because he wasn't sure Caesars would be around in 5 years.
He was pretty close to being accurate on that one. Vegas has changed so much over the years. But you brought up an interesting point, and George Burns is a great example of that. And because Totsky's 98 and, you know, still going too from that standpoint. But the stage does something to performers. And I remember watching, going to a Sonny Rollins concert not that many years ago. And Sonny came out with his tenor saxophone. He was hunched over and stuff. But once he put that horn in his mouth, magic happened. And it happens regularly when you talk to people, especially performers who are getting a little up in age. It's just like this transformative, magical thing that happens once they hit the stage.
No question. But I saw Bob Hope do that. I saw Frank. All the years I toured with Frank, everybody knew that 5 minutes before the show, you left him alone. You know, he would, like, when we did bigger, when we worked Vegas or Tahoe or any of the casinos, I would finish my show. He'd walk on right after me and bring me back out for a bow. But when we worked the big arena, they would take an intermission after my show. So I would go in the dressing room, we'd say, "How's the crowd? Oh, great crowd." We'd talk for a few minutes, but everybody knew, leave him alone 5 minutes before he went on. And when he was like 78 years old, I'd watch him pace backstage, getting ready to enter. And I'd say, "Boy, look at this guy. He should be home with his grandchildren. He should be, you know, enjoying life. He's going out and has to prove himself again to 20,000 people, you know." And he would look really like, look, he looked 78, he looked 80, 85, whatever. But the moment that light hit him, 20 years fell off of his face, and "Come fly with me." And he was a kid again, you know. It's something that you just can't get over, you know, how much an audience, appreciative audience, can do for you, you know, stimulate you to keep going on, you know.
Yeah, and his music still lives on. I mean, it's crazy to think about the artist and such. And one of my all-time favorite artists is Billy Joel. And I bring that up because he, ironically, was having a conversation with Bruce Springsteen. Both those guys are, I'm not going to say how old they are, they're in their 70s, right? And Springsteen goes out there, and Springsteen's in great shape, and Billy's not in such great shape, but he's still a great performer. And the conversation was about, when are we going to stop performing? When are we going to stop going on the road? And they looked at each other, and I think it was Springsteen that said, "This is what we do. We'll only stop when we die. When we can't, when they got to wheel us up to the stage, who knows, what have you. And this is what we do. So we're going to keep doing it."
And why not? I mean, whatever you are, if you're a tugboat captain, I don't care. If you love your work, if you get out of, if you have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And that, you know, retiring, I've known more people that retired and within a couple of years died, you know, because we're designed to do certain things. When you find the work that you love, you're on your way. I remember an old Irish thing that the second you come out of the womb, God whispers in your ear what it is he wants you to do. And you spend the rest of your life working for that, looking for that whisper. And when you find it, the wind gets at your back for the rest of your life. I'm paraphrasing that statement, but it stuck in my mind many times, you know. I wandered aimlessly. I had a wife and 3 kids. I came out of the service, you know. I wandered aimlessly. I worked on a loading dock. I was a Teamster, and I dropped my card, and I became management. I was managing 48 Teamsters. I was a foreman. And then I also went from one trucking company to another. I was helped my brother in the photography business. I was a bartender. I wandered aimlessly. I sold life insurance. And I'd be in a bar with my buddies at 2 o'clock in the morning saying, I don't belong here, but I didn't know where I belonged. And then I went on stage, Tim Reed, we were America's first black and white comedy team. And there weren't any comedy clubs in those days. So we were these, what they call the Chitlin' Circuit, black owned, black operated nightclubs in the North and the South. But the first time I went on stage with Tim, something I had written got a laugh right from the beginning. And it was like one of those B movies where the dark clouds open up and the sun bursts through. My whole being went, oh, yeah. Oh, this is what I want to do. I want to be a comedian. The thought that you might make a living making people laugh overwhelmed me. That you can honestly maybe make a living making people laugh. You know? And that was it. And I went through hardship after hardship. But I've been doing it. This is my 55th year in show business, and I'm still working.
And so would you think that maybe you got a place on Mount Rushmore somewhere? Obviously, Richard Pryor's up there, George Carlin. But longevity and such, I mean, it's bigger than four guys. Let's get it straight. But the guys, when you were starting out and stuff, I mean, I think of Buddy and I Don Rickles. I mean, these guys are just like huge stars, because when you started out, like you said, there were no comedy clubs. Now everybody wants to be or thinks they can be a stand-up comedian. It's insane how it's changed.
You know what? Years ago, you would say to somebody, somebody would say to you, this is when I first started out, they say, what do you do? I said, I'm a comedian. I went, wow, Martha, honey, come here, honey. He's a comedian. He's a stand-up comedian. This is what they say today. Somebody would say, what do you do for a living? I would say, I'm a comedian. They say, yeah, so's my dentist. My dentist does it on weekends. You know, my wife's gynecologist. He does stand-up, too. Everybody. There's probably 15,000 comedians out there today. You know, and when I started out, there weren't any comedy clubs. And then years later, there was 550 comedy clubs. Tulsa, Oklahoma had three. So these comedy rooms, you had to have inventory to fill up those billets. And a lot of good comedians came out of there, and a lot of mediocre came out of there, too.
So how do you know when you're a good comedian, and how do you know when you're a mediocre comedian? Or does the person not want to have that realization if they're mediocre?
Depending on your personality, but it's consistency. It's like anything else. You know, when I first started doing stand-up, well, Tim and I, when we were a comedy team, we stayed together almost 6 years. We worked on our routines because we weren't working. There was no open mic nights in those days because there weren't any comedy clubs. So we had to go. We had like a rehearse at home. You know, we just go to each other's houses and rehearse at home after the kids went to bed, you know. But the when you got consistent with your laughter, you know, when I became a single, when the team broke up, it was the same thing. You start out with 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then 20 minutes, and pretty soon you got yourself a 30-minute act. And when you start going on stage and that consistently gets laughs, you know, you did 10 shows in a row and it didn't bomb, you're on your way now. The other thing too is there's a thing that can happen. Get caught in the act of being yourself. You know, Candid Camera had that cliche, caught in the act of being yourself. New comedians go on stage and usually they do an impression of another comedian because they know that work. And I can watch a new comedian and say, gee, he likes Jay Leno or he likes Dave Letterman or whatever, Jerry Seinfeld. But after a while, you'll let a little bit of you out one night, and if it doesn't get a laugh, you go back into doing that impression. Then one night when you're trying out new material, you somehow ad-lib something of your own and you get to laugh. And then you let a little bit more of you out, and pretty soon a little bit more of you out, and pretty soon you are yourself on stage, and that's when you start to grow in leaps and bounds.
Yeah, finding yourself is interesting. I mean, that's really what you aspire to do. That's what you're trying to do from the get-go, I would think, is, you know, once you hit that stage, is we're with a comedy legend. Yeah, I'll call him that. It's Tom Dreesen. We'll be back after this break.
Hi, this is John O'Hurley reminding you you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones. I haven't been this excited since I discovered I couldn't lick my elbow.
We're back with Tom Dreesen, renowned comedian and a guy. Another comedian. No, this guy has played rooms with Sinatra and he knew the Rat Pack. And, you know, again, I sound like I'm aging my guest, but, you know, I think that you've lived not only a tremendous life, but to be born when you were born and to have exposure to the quality of people that you've been exposed to, I don't know how you digest it.
Well, you know, again, I repeat, there were eight of us kids, four boys and four girls. We lived in a shack in a suburb on the south side of Chicago called Harvey, Illinois. And I shined shoes in taverns. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. I sold newspapers on the corner, all to feed my brothers and sisters. And none of this do I regret, you know, but growing up that poor, you know, when I was shining shoes in the bars, Frank Sinatra was on all the jukeboxes, you know, and then growing up that poor gave me a little bit of stick to it, you know, not to give up. I was a street kid. I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets. I grew up on the streets. And then to one day, you know, my one-man show, I'm babbling all over the place here, but my one-man show is called The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh. It's a 90-minute show that I do in theaters around the country. But a screen comes down, and Dennis Farina, God rest his soul, narrates a film of my life. And then, you know, my years in the service and all that stuff, and leading to being the first black member of the first black and white comedy team with Tim Reed, and then on to doing The Tonight Show 60 times and, you know, and then meeting Sinatra and so forth and so on. But in there, after I do my stand-up, I go to a bar and on the stage. There's a bottle of Jack Daniels, which was Frank's drink of choice. And I tell the audience, I you know, Frank comes on the screen and he's singing to me, you know, to the bartender. It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. When he gets to the chorus, make it one for my baby and one more for the road, he goes off screen and the spotlight hits me. And I tell the audience, the first time I heard that voice, I was 10 years old, shining shoes in a bar on the south side of Chicago. And then I take the audience from that little boy hearing Sinatra on the jukebox on the south side of Chicago to one day carrying his coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills, California. So I take him on that journey. And there's you know, still photos and video that authenticate every story that I'm telling. But it's, and why this show is always a big hit, because, you know, people vicariously sometimes live through that. You had a childhood like that, maybe, or you had a dream like that. And, you know, I lived my dream. Everything that I ever prayed for came true. You know, that it's a triumph story, but it and there's a lot of tears in it. There's laughter and a lot of tears in it as well. But it's just, you know, sometimes when you mention all the people that I've known in my career, it sounds like name dropping, and I cringe when I hear that. But that you were a little boy seeing movies in the Harvey Theater where I grew up at, and all these stars one day became your friends. You know, that you listened to music. You know, Smokey Robinson, I toured with Smokey for years, with the best of friends. I pinch myself sometimes, you know, when I was in their company. You know, if I close my eyes, Keith, no matter where I'm at, if I close my eyes, I see a little boy, 10 years old, with a shoeshine box, trudging through the snow, going from tavern to tavern, trying to make money to feed his brothers and sisters. That's who I am. I'm really not. I'm a comedian. I'm all these other things. But that's who I am. That's where it all comes from that little boy.
Super awesome. The internet says you're only worth $1 million. You are worth $1 million being on this show. But I know that's, you know, you can't believe everything you read. I think some numbers fell off of there. But you have been in a lot of movies, and I know you and Mr. Eastwood are buddies. So you got some bit roles and stuff. But that was definitely a different opportunity for you away from the stage.
Well, you know, I studied acting in Chicago, and I studied acting out here in L.A., where I live in L.A., and I studied acting. So I never, you know, I've done a lot of, I did Murder, She Wrote in Columbo's, and even did WKRP with Cincinnati with Tim. I've done a lot of those kind of TV shows. And then I did movies. You know, I was, as you pointed out, I was in trouble with the curve with Clint. But I did, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 movies. I don't know what I did, but I never liked it. Stand-up comedy, you come out of your dressing room 15 minutes before the show, you go on stage, you know, you do your show, you walk off, they hand you a check or, you know, but it's doing acting. You get on the set sometimes at 6 o'clock in the morning and they shoot your scene at 4 in the afternoon. You've been sitting in your trailer all day long, you know, and you're going over your lines till it's nauseating. You know, it's fun doing the acting. It's horrible waiting for it to happen. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. As we're with Tom Dreesen, we're waiting for the bottom of the hour to happen, and we'll be back with the all-around comedian.
The Dalai Lama. So I'm on a first tee with him. I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter.
The Lama.
Long. Into a 10,000 foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
And we're back to start the second half hour of the show. Honored to have Tom Dreesen back on the show. And I can't say I'm going to even come close to tonight's show's record of 60 appearances. I can't believe Johnny brought you back that many times. That speaks volumes from that standpoint. Oh, by the way, Tom Dreesen was in Spaceballs. That's right there. I mean, that was probably Academy Award winning performance. But what a movie that was.
Let me tell you how I got that role. This is a true story. I just got divorced, and I was dating a girl. It was like my second date with her. She's tall, beautiful girl. Her name was Trish, and just a beautiful girl. And I did a set at the Improvisation in Santa Monica, and we went there and I did a set there, trying up some new material. And I went across the street to a restaurant. And I'm in the restaurant. The table wasn't ready, so I was sitting at the bar. I was sitting, but the girl was standing because she's so tall and pretty. She said she didn't want to sit. And Mel Brooks happened to be in that restaurant, and he saw her. So he wandered all the way around, and he come walking up because she's a very pretty girl. And he saw me sitting there. He said, "Hey, Dreesen, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, Mel, how you doing? This is my friend Trish, blah, blah, blah." And we talked for a minute or two. He said, "What are you doing Monday?" This was on a Saturday night. He said, "What are you doing Monday?" I said, "What do you want me to do Monday?" He said, "Well, I'm doing a movie." I said, "I'll do it." He said, "Wait a minute, I didn't even tell you about it." I said, "I don't care. I'll sweep the floor to be around Mel Brooks." He said, "It's got a few lines in it." And it was a 2-day shoot for me, you know, and that's how I got the role. Meanwhile, that movie, of all the films I've ever done, that movie is aired more than any film that I've ever done. I get checks now for like $1.29 and, you know, something like that. But it was a fun movie to do with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner were around, and we laughed all day long, you know.
Yeah, I bet you that was a treat. I tell you, this is the inspiration that you were to Mel Brooks, because he ended up with Anne Bancroft. So I'm still trying to figure that one out to this day, but, you know.
what a brilliant actress. She passed away, God rest her soul. But what a brilliant actress. Have you ever seen her in the movie in Turning Point? If you're an actor or an actress, whatever, and you want to see a classic bit of acting, it's when Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft get into this big fight, and every emotion that you need is in. I mean, there's joy, there's sadness, there's anger, there's rage. All of it happens in this one scene. She was an incredible actress, as well as Shirley was to be. Is.
Yeah, acting is interesting. I took a couple classes. I did actually. I was in an episode, non-speaking role, with Kevin Spacey, doing that White House thing, and. I've been in a couple other small movies, independents, but I bring that up because you made an interesting comment, and that was the time that you spend sitting around. Call time was like dark 30, and you were there all day, and it was, the people do this for a living, huh?
Yeah.
Versus going up on stage and doing that for a living.
Yeah, you know, again, I don't want to exaggerate, but I probably turned down more sitcoms than most comedians get offered in a lifetime during the years that I was touring with Frank. Because here I was, touring with Frank Sinatra, flying all over the world in his private jet, staying in his home six times a year, just enjoying his company. And then I was also playing golf on that Celebrity Players Tour at the same time, 12 cities a year. And they paid you to play golf, almost like the LIV Tour is today. But if you had told me when I was a little boy, I was an athlete, I played a lot of sports. I played football, I played basketball, and played a lot of sports. If you had told me when I was a little boy, first of all, you're the guy in the jukebox, one day you're going to fly in this private jet all over the world and grace the same stage as him, and you're also going to be playing you're going to get inside of an arena, and you're going to compete with the greatest athletes who ever lived in your lifetime. I would say that's absolutely impossible. There's no way I could do that. And here I was doing that. And Christopher Morley, the author, once said, success is living the life you want. And so whenever they offered me a sitcom role, it was, you know, like I said, you'd go there all week long and actors and actors arguing about who gets the bigger laugh. I've been on those kind of shows. You know, again, I could have been a lot wealthier and a lot well-known, but I would never have had the memories that I have. And I read a philosopher once said, in the end, all you have are memories, so make some good ones. Man, I made some real good ones.
No question about it. We're talking to Tom Dreesen, renowned comedian on Tita Keith Jones, and talking about the golf. So I covered a few of those CPT, Celebrity Players Tour tournaments, and it was interesting. You know, getting to talk with Schmidt and actually I think Pesci showed up to one of them. It was insane. That was not he was not acting when he acted. That was how he acted. It was crazy. I remember Lee, and I wish I could remember Lee's last name. He was always doing PR.
I'll say his name in a minute. But he was head of our
program. It'll come to us old guys in a minute here. But he was. I reach out to him every once in a while. But he was more than knee deep in that. And Kenny Singletary, who played for the Orioles, still has some tournaments and different guys like that kind of have their own way before the thing in Tahoe has happened. But when you're playing in the Crosby, which comes to AT&T and the Bob Hope and such, and not to be a downer, but when you, because I have had this conversation with Dan Quinn, who played in the NHL, very successful, and he was playing. He won in Tahoe. And one year, they decided not to invite him. There was somebody else they wanted to invite, and he got his slot taken from him. What's it like when that call comes? How do you digest that?
The call doesn't come. They don't call you. I played in that tournament for 11 years in the Lake Tahoe tournament. And, you know, and it happens that those things happen in our business all the time. You're hot and you're not, or you know, but it didn't bother me at all. I was playing way too much golf. You know, I was between all the tournaments I was playing in, and then I wanted to concentrate more on my comedy career as well. But it just happens. They one day just don't call you, you know, it's almost like Augusta. You know, Augusta, when you are a member at Augusta, that you don't pay a monthly bill, you know, for your golf. At the end of the year, they bill you. And if you don't get a bill at the end of the year, you're not wanted back. That's your message, you know.
Oops. I got you that way. Yeah. But Quinny had won that tournament, so he thought for sure it was like a lifetime exemption, but was not the case, indeed.
Yeah, well, but you know, they go by the numbers, and the guys who run that tournament, you know, that were running that tournament from NBC, we were the first ones. We played in that tournament there one year, the CPT, the Celebrity Players Tour, and that's how they got the idea. And then eventually, they took over that spot on TV. But the guys who ran it were really, we call them jock sniffers. They were a couple of guys that just really, they were so enamored by athletes. You know, and they wanted to hang out with them and go to dinner with them and then pretend that they were the best of friends, you know. You know, John Elway and Dan Marino, two terrific guys, but you'd hear these NBC executives saying, yeah, Danny said to me last night, you know, and John said to me, they were truly, we call them jock sniffers, you know.
Yeah, that sounds exactly right, because I have no knock on anybody that has played at the professional level. I get it. But sometimes you look at the list of people they're going to invite you like, huh, yeah, I know he played in the major leagues, but, you know, Yeah, sure. It's not like Mike. It wasn't Mike Schmidt. You know, one of those things. But yeah, you bring up very valid points, which is one of the reasons we're having this guest on this hour, just because we like to talk golf and talk about life and comedy, and nobody's lived a more fruitful life than this hour's guest, Tom Dreesen.
Well, thank you.
well, you're welcome. But it's like, you know, you're still doing it. You're still out there. But let's go back to when you started. How do you and Tim Reed and you mentioned WKRP? That's probably besides being one of the greatest shows ever on television or ever produced. Tim was one of the stars in that. So that's likely where a lot of people know him, especially from the younger generation, who forget a lot of people who have been very successful over the years. But how do you and Tim get together to start this comedy duo?
It was purely by, that's how I got into comedy, purely by accident. Again, I was wandering aimlessly when I came out of service and wife and three kids. And I joined a civic group called the JCs. It was Young Men of Action in those days, the former Junior Chamber of Commerce, but it was called the JCs. And it was young men from age 18 to 36. After you're 36, you moved on. But you worked on community projects. Wherever there were problems in the community, these young men of action would go out and tackle that problem. And doing so, they taught you a lot about leadership. You know, you learned how to serve on a committee, how to chair a committee. You know, you learned the subcommittees. You learned how Robert's Rules of Order, how to conduct a meeting. And then they had speak-up programs, teaching how to speak in front of an audience. But you attack the problems of the community. And one of the problems in our community were young youth using drugs, as is today, even going that far back, as is today. So I wrote a drug education program teaching eighth graders the ills of drug abuse. And I had some humor in it, some ideas about playing some records and getting their attention and planting the seeds of the ills of drug abuse. And I proposed it as a JC project. One night at a meeting, I proposed it, wanted the JCs to sanction it. And after the meeting, a young guy comes up to me, and he had this black friend with him, and he said, this is my, he's a new member, Tim Reed. And Tim said, I'd like to work with you on that program. And as fate would have it, I said, gee, I'm sorry. I already got a guy. I had a white friend named John DeBoer. And the next day, John DeBoer called me and said, Tom, I can't work with you on that project. I got a new job. I said, gee, what was that black guy's name? Oh, yeah, Tim Reed. I said, Tim, I met with Tim. We worked on the program. When we walked into the classroom, I realized what a blessing it was, because the children were black and white. It was in integrated classes. And the moment we hit, and we were young guys, and then we hit that classroom, we had their immediate attention. And we got them laughing back and forth, and we planted the seeds of, it was a drug abuse in that community. One day, a little eighth grade girl walking out of the classroom pointed at Tim and I, and she said, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team. And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us, because no one had ever done that before. And we kept in touch with that girl to this day. You know, she's now a grown woman, you know, but and got grandchildren, but as a matter of fact. But anyhow, we started working on what we thought would be material. And, you know, we didn't know anything about writing jokes or anything like that at all. So it was a lot of ups and downs, a lot of hills and valleys. My wife didn't want me to do it. His wife was very encouraging and, you know, a lot of struggles. But we finally went on stage and we became America's first black and white comedy team. We lasted for 6 years, paid dues like no other comedy team ever had to pay. Working black clubs in the North and the South and working white clubs. We ended up doing the Playboy circuit, doing 17 Playboy clubs around the country. We did a couple of national television shows, but Tim finally wanted to go off and be more of an actor. You know? And we're still the best of friends to this day.
Fascinating story, Tom. And you know, to do that, that comedy, that, I mean, groundbreaking, not just the salt and pepper angle, but also early on where there were no comedy clubs. So for those aspiring dentists or gynecologists that want to be stand-up comedians, what do you suggest to them? How do they not just do it? I'm open mic night. I can go and do it after I finish doing the show with you if I wanted to do that. But how do they hone that craft, and how do they elevate themselves to another level?
Well, you know, I'd say start where you are. Number one, start where you are, wherever you're at, Toledo, Cheyenne, Wyoming, start where you are. Get up on stages, start where you are. And The next thing is to work as often as you can. Get up on stage every opportunity you can, even if it's just emceeing a charity or, you know, but every opportunity, get up on stage and try to get, you know. Three, read the book The Magic of Believing by Claude Bristol. You know, if you can't believe in yourself, you know, how you can get out of this to believe in you, read that book. Four, realize no one is ever going to help you. You're going to have to do it. Put a sign on your desk saying, if it is to be, it's up to me. Because until you, no one is ever going to help you until you are marketable. You know, we're in show business. That's two words, show and business. If they can make money off of you, then that's when they're going to represent you. But, you know, you're going to have to do it all yourself. You're going to have to build this act. Five, don't ever quit. Bertram Russell once said, there are people in show business who become major stars simply because they didn't have sense enough to quit when they should have. Those are the five steps I would tell you. The last thing I'd tell you is, if you don't know how to write a joke, you better learn how to write one. Because, you know, some people could write a new 5 minutes or maybe a new 10 minutes, but you're going to have to keep writing new material the rest of your life, you know, coming up with a whole act, you know. So if you can't write jokes, if you're not good at writing jokes, either take a class on it or hopefully you'll have enough money to hire writers, you know. Otherwise, you'll fall short after a certain period of time. Yeah. Every time I did, as you pointed out earlier, I did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, but I did over 500 appearances on national television. Every time we do The Tonight Show, you had to do a new 5 minutes. Johnny Carson didn't want you to come on there and do two guys going to bar jokes, you know. So you had to come up with new material all the time. So, you know, that's the test you were put to in those days. In those days, if somebody said to you, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. They'd say, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson? If you hadn't been on Johnny Carson in the eyes of America, you weren't a comedian. So, you know, I watched that show. How do you get on? You had to write material that could make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and the kids laugh. Mm-hmm. Today, you don't have to do that. Today, you got cable television. You can work as filthy as you want. But, you know, it was a long answer to a very short question. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. That was great. I'm a big follower of Eddie Murphy, mostly because he's, you know, he's a very talented guy. But I went to see him tour, and he was doing the Raw series, and it was worse than Raw. I mean, it was everything was a 4-letter word. There was like no quality in the comedy. I was so dismayed, so disillusioned. It was very, very disappointing.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you a funny story. I was at the Laugh Factory a while back, and I was waiting around the corner. I was going to try out some new material in Hollywood, Laugh Factory in Hollywood. And there were two young comedians on the other side of the room, and I didn't know they were there, and they didn't know I was there. And one of them said, hey, you know, Tom Dreesen's here tonight. And the other guy said, oh, yeah, you know, he's old school. And the other comedian said, what do you mean? He said, well, he doesn't use the F word. He said, he doesn't use the F word. What does he use for adjectives? And I stuck my head around the corner, and I said, adjectives. Because, you know, that's, you know, they grew up on watching cable television. Hey, I'm not a prude. I mean, I could do a stag roast with the best of them, but I couldn't make any money in those days working glue, you know. But now cable television came along. By that time, I was already doing what I do, you know, and you can say whatever you want to say, and, you know, on cable television. I follow women sometimes. I'll stop at the Comedy Store or at the Laugh Factory. I follow women that Red Fox would walk out of the room being embarrassed, you know.
That's saying something, because that guy was red was blue. I'll let Tommy tell more about the great Red Fox when we come back after this final break on Tee It Up with Keith Jones. Try not to laugh out loud too much this hour. I've been chuckling in the background and such as Tom Dreesen always comes through. He's not trying to be funny. He just is funny. And the Red Fox thing before we went to the break was classic, because I never got a chance to see him. Obviously, Sanford and Son was a huge show for him. But for people that saw him perform, whether it's Vegas or wherever, Red Fox had a, as we mom would say, had a dirty mouth.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was always that way. He was the first one to put out what they call party records. You know, he was, that's who Red was. That's who Red Fox was. He was the nicest guy in the world. I knew Red. I loved him. He was the nicest guy in the world. In fact, I did his show one time. You know, Sammy Davis directed an episode of his show, and I had a small part in there. But I liked Red a lot. But that's what he did. Now, the interesting thing in those days, though, Bob Newhart had a hit show at the same time Red Fox had a hit show. Red Fox would work at the Hacienda doing his triple X-rated show, and I think he was making maybe $20,000 or $25,000 a week, while Bob Newhart was making $125,000 a week for his show at Caesars or wherever he worked at. But, you know, so, it, again, today it's totally different. The bluest comics in the world, and for those who are listening to your show, when we say blue, we mean off-color, you know, color kind of comedy. They fill arenas today, you know. Young kids today start going to comedy clubs when they're 18 and 19 years old, and they see these stand-up comedians doing all that blue material, and they say, oh, that's what comedy is. Or they watch cable television, and they watch women talking about having sex with, you know, with their husbands, or they, you know, and getting really graphic, you know, and they say, oh, that's what comedy is. When we were growing up, we'd see a Jack Benny or a Bob Hope or a George Burns, or, and you'd say, oh, that's what comedy is. You know what I mean? But so it's just gone to another area now. And again, I'm not a prude. I'm a street guy. I spent 4 years in the military. I know every dirty joke there was, and I can tell them with the best of them, but I couldn't make any money doing that. And you know, so it's, that's what I had to do. I had to learn to work clean.
That's when you know that you have to work hard to do that. So how many two guys walk into a bar jokes does Tom Dreesen know?
Oh, my God. I mean, again, that's not original material. I was a bartender, you know, before I was ever in show business. I was a bartender, and I used to tell jokes behind the bar, you know, a lot. And you get some tips, you know, better tips, you know. But there's, you know, I mean, there's so many variations on two guys walk into a bar. You know, I mean, it's always three different ethnicities, you know, like a priest and a rabbi, and a priest, a rabbi, and a Methodist minister walk into a bar, and the bartender says, what is this, some kind of joke? You know. or the other one is two Irishmen walk out of a bar, and you pause and say, could happen, you know.
See, this is free performance right now by the one and only Tom Dreesen. But your big money show these days, The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh, how many will you continue to do in a year?
Well, I've done as many as once a month, you know. And then lately, you know, a couple times I slowed down because I'm doing a lot of other things. I give motivation talks on four subjects: perception, visualization, self-talk, and develop a sense of humor. And I elaborate on those four things to corporate America, and they pay me. And then I do it free to comedians. I've held two at the Comedy Store this year, one at the Laugh Factory. I do it in Chicago, New York, Boston, wherever the comedy clubs are. I'll do that as a favor to them, you know. And I call it the joy of stand-up comedy and how to get there. Because let me digress. I've known five comedians who committed suicide in my life, five very funny comedians. In my humble opinion, 85% of all stand-up comedians are, you know, insecure, neurotic, sometimes psychotic, loved, starved wrecks. And the other 15% are gifted, confident people who say, I know how to write a joke, and I know how to tell one. I like to think I'm in the latter, but never trust somebody that tells you they're sane. So what I do when I talk to the young comedians, I want them to enjoy this journey, this wonderful journey of making people laugh. And I explain to them that laughter is healing. It used to be a theory. It's not a theory anymore. UCLA did research on what happens to the human body when you laugh, that endorphins are released from the brain into the bloodstream when you laugh heartily. You laugh so hard sometimes you have tears and you go, oh, and that sense of well-being comes over you. So laughter is not only psychologically a deterrent, it's physiologically therapeutic. So comedians, therefore, are physicians of the soul. So you can call me Dr. Dreesen if you want.
I'll call him cute if nothing else. But Tom Dreesen, renowned comedian, my guest on TV, Keith Jones. We're just out of time. Tom, he could talk for a long time. He gets paid by corporate America. But we're out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Practice your stand-up, too. Practice. Take your game to the next level, and we will talk to you next week. Take care.